morning. Welcome into the 9 to 10 show. It is 9:09, and this is a Forensic Friday. Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson with us as almost always. We give Ray a couple of weeks a year off, but he's with us this morning. Good morning, Ray.
Good morning.
Tell us who you brought with, who you brung.
Well, we always bring the cast of thousands, as Scott Johnson says.
Yep.
With us this morning is Lieutenant Scott Blakely, who is the head of the narcotics operation for the Lexington Police Department.
Hey, Scott.
Good morning.
Also with us is Katie Webster, a prosecutor, and David Startzman, a prosecutor. And we're here to talk about a case that is probably one of the common cases that we deal with that we don't talk about much. It's a drug trafficking case, meaning a dope dealer. Mm-hmm. And it's drugs play a significant role in probably the majority of crime in Lexington. Almost all of the property crimes, I think, are probably have some connection to drugs or supporting a habit or that sort of thing. So, and it's the name of the case is Commonwealth versus Brandon Moment. David, tell me a little bit about how did we get this case?
Well, the narcotics division was surveilling a house, and at the time they got enough probable cause to get a search warrant, and they executed that search warrant.
Okay, but the question here's the what I'm really getting at. This case was not assigned to you and Katie.
No, sir.
Yeah, who was it assigned to?
Well, the original prosecutor on the case was Ben Starkey.
Right.
And he had since left our office.
And he's become a police officer. Yeah.
That's pretty unusual, isn't it?
I think, let me tell you how this works. Interns in our office that want to be social workers or something else frequently do internships in our office and then decide they want to go to law school. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you have prosecutors who decide, I'd like to be a policeman because I think I would like to do that.
And sometimes it works the other way. We've had policemen who have become prosecutors.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And so it works, but it's almost always in this arena. So this was whose case?
This was Ben Starkey's case, and it was arraigned in circuit court on March 8th of 2012. So this is a pretty old case.
All right.
And then when Ben left, Dan Laren inherited the case and prosecuted it and kind of took it through the 15 different status hearings that they had. And
okay, why do you have the case if it was Dan's?
Well, Dan had two trials set on the same day.
Mm-hmm.
And so he asked Katie and myself if we would be able to help him out and take this case from him and try this one while he was in the another division trying another case.
Okay, now this is an interesting phenomenon, Jack. I'm going to be a whiny baby a lot today.
Okay.
First of all, this case happened in 2012, and it had. And David mentioned something about status hearings, and he said there were 15 status hearings.
What's a status hearing?
Yeah.
The status hearing is where the defense attorney and the defendant go in front of the judge, and at that time they either can plead guilty, address motions that have been filed, if there's a suppression motion filed or anything like that, to set a hearing date at a later date, to set a trial date, or just to kind of give the judge an idea of where we are in the case and what's going on and how we're proceeding.
So 15 would be an abnormally high number, I would guess?
The status hearings are also occasions for the defense attorney to ask for another status hearing.
Ah.
And another one and another one. And this one went on for 15 status hearings. And who was the judge in this case?
This was in the 7th Division, Judge Scorsone.
All right, Ernesto Scorsone let it go on and on and on and on. Was this guy in custody or was he out?
He was out of custody.
Of course he was out. He made some sort of bond. And why would he want to have it tried? Because he's just living his life out there. And they were successful in getting the case put off for, 2 years? Yeah, okay. So ultimately, he ended up going to trial, right?
Yep, went to trial on July 23rd, 2014.
Okay, now, Scott David said a couple of things. Scott Blakely.
Scott, turn that mic around on you there.
There you go.
Thank you.
David said a couple of things in that are very interesting to me, and I hope interesting to everybody else. He said that a house was under surveillance and that enough evidence to warrant probable cause to allow you all to obtain a search warrant to search that house. Tell us, make some sense out of all of that for the people listening, because this is, in fact, crime fighter training.
Well, generally, we'll get a call or a text or something off the website or through Crime Stoppers, a piece of information that someone provides that either a person or a location they're selling drugs out of. So we can't act specifically on that piece of information. We have to verify what they've told us. So we usually go out and we'll conduct surveillance. In this case, I think someone in the neighborhood must have called and said that there was drugs being sold from that house. I think it had been the location of a shooting incident where some shots had been fired through the door or something, and obviously that causes people concern. So we go out and we'll surveil that through various means and gather information and verify what the caller tells us, and gather other evidence that helps lead us to apply for a search warrant. And then a judge will review that warrant and either grant it or not grant it, and then we'll gather a team together and go serve that warrant or show up on a day to enter that residence and search for illegal activity.
Okay. Now, when you serve, we've all seen search warrants being served on television. And a lot of times, the people on television that do search warrants just ransack a house. Does that happen?
It can happen. It depends upon how clever the narcotics trafficker is. You know, we've gotten narcotics out of walls. We've gotten it out of hides. We've gotten it out of smoke detectors. We've gotten it out of electrical outlets. And sometimes it's in hidden containers that might be found in the kitchen. I mean, if you can imagine, we've gotten it out of the toilet before, the freezer, the refrigerator. So
it's like hiding money, Jack.
Right. You know, it could be anywhere in the house. And generally, we take a lot of people to do a search warrant. In this case, as an example, why? Because we want to have more assets than the bad guy has. And when we entered this residence, there was five or six people in there, and we ended up recovering lots of evidence in narcotic trafficking, a couple of firearms. But that's the potential danger for us, and that's why we try to take more people than we need.
Now, do you all, when you serve a search warrant, do you all wear vests and
armored
vests?
We do. It's required. Everyone on the search warrant wears protective equipment. We have protective helmets. We have protective vests. We have our equipment with us to control an individual. We take all kinds of options with us so that we will be able to respond to whatever we encounter inside.
Okay. Now, Jack, this leads me to another whiny issue.
Okay.
And it's called the discussion about the militarization of police. And when our own Senator Rand Paul, from the safety of his Senate office, was complaining and telling police how they ought to be equipped, I asked a number of police officers, and one of whom is Scott. I said, why do you have to have that kind of equipment? So go ahead.
Well, again, this is a classic example. Here you have five or six individuals inside, all involved probably, and all of them got charged with something, so they're all involved in drug trafficking or other illegal activity. There had been a history of shots fired incidents. They had fired a gun inside this residence, and it had gone into the residence next door, barely missing a mother and her child, I think. So, I mean, those are types of things. We always get guns. Just about every single time we do a search warrant for narcotics, we find guns. Those are two things that are close proximity. Hopefully, we never have to use those tools, and we don't want to have to use them. We hope everybody complies, but that's just not the case. In this instance, they fled down the hall. They fought the police. We ended up having to use a taser on one of the people. So those are all reasons why we have to take all the tools that we have with us. And, you know, we train with those, and we tell people how to use them, and we hope they're used appropriately. And, you know, for the most part, we do. And if we make a mistake, then we have to deal with that in later. But that's the reason why we take all of that equipment with us, is simply for protection.
We're taking a break. 253-5959, touch star 590. From AT&T, toll-free from anywhere, 1-877-777-0590. Email jackpatty at W. Forensic Friday, Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson with us in the studio this morning. And we also have Katie Webster and David Startzman. They are Assistant Commonwealth's Attorneys. Lieutenant Scott Blakely from the Police Department. Now, let me explain this real quick. We're not changing our subject. We are going to change it for just a second. This is a very short segment here, and then we got to get an update from Scott. But I got a letter here, an email, Ray, and it kind of tickled me, because you guys, Ray and Katie and David and Scott, deal with the small percentage of people who break the law, but the vast majority of people out there are just good people.
95%.
Yeah, they don't want to break the law, and they even worry about breaking the law unintentionally. So here's a guy that's so honest. This is from Lou. And it says, you'll like this, Scott. It says, this email might be long, and I hope you'll be able to proofread it, blah, blah, blah. Okay, it says, I bought a pistol from a security guard back in 1992 for $40. I had asked him if it was a stolen gun. He laughed and said no, but also stated that if it was, I would be okay. That's been 22 years ago, and I still live with the fear that I am in the possession of a possible stolen gun. Now, I'm not making fun of this guy. I'm proud of this guy. I am a law-abiding citizen, and I have thought about calling the police and having the serial number run to make sure that it isn't a stolen gun that I purchased, but I am in fear that if it did come back stolen, that I'd be arrested and charged with the possession of a stolen firearm. I've never loaded nor fired the gun, but I have wanted to do so, to go to the gun range, but don't want to because of the fear of lying about the gun, blah, blah, blah. He goes on, could you ask Ray on your program, how can I find out if this gun is stolen without remorse, and if it turns out that it happens to be a stolen gun, how can I avoid being charged with having a registered stolen gun? I have lived with this nightmare for 22 years now.
Well, he's typical of 95% of the population that want to obey the law.
Yeah.
And if I were in Lou's position, I would take that gun right down to the police department, walk in, and ask, who can I talk to about finding out if this is a stolen gun? And they'll do it, and the police aren't going to do anything. If it's stolen, he may end up losing it. It may, you know, he may have to give it up, but
you agree, Scott?
Well, first of all, before you take the gun in, let's make sure it's unloaded so we don't have any accidents.
That's a good
in the
point.
Lobby.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
If you have a fear of going into the police department, you know, most officers are going to run that gun for you and tell you whether it's stolen or not. You can call me in my office directly, you know, and I'll take care
What's
of it.
What's your number?
You.
That's a good idea.
My number is 258-3630, and that rings directly to my desk, and I would advise him just to give me a call, and I'll see if I can handle it for him.
Excellent. That's great. I'm going to take a break. We'll be right back. 253-5959. Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson, Katie Webster, David Startzman, Assistant Commonwealth's Attorneys, and Lieutenant Scott Blakely. And going into the break, Ray, if I read the caller correctly, I think he was saying, well, why don't we make it, you know, hard on the guys that are dealing, but let's not make it a crime to use, and if you use and you die, so what? And how much money did all this cost us?
Well, he talked in terms of $50,000. In this case that we're talking about today, the judge is there regardless. Mm-hmm. The public defender, his salary is paid regardless whether he represents this guy or somebody else. The prosecutors are on salary, and this is another case. So basically, the cost is not increased for those reasons. The police are busy doing their deal, and that's there's really not a cost issue when the public defender is involved. But I kind of got the impression from David's question or statement was that decriminalize possession and go hard after the people that deal. And I can't agree with the decriminalization. We got back to this point about Lou, who called us about the gun, right?
Right.
If it's against the law, most people will try to obey the law. If you give society's approval of drug usage, then it's not against the law, and a significant number more people will begin to use it. So that's a concern. Now, I'll tell you, this legalization of marijuana is turning into kind of a nightmare.
In Colorado?
Where they've done it. And it's, I mean, you're talking about the smoking marijuana is old news. Now they're smoking the THC concentrate that's in, they call it wax, or the just the liquid. They put it in a something called a vaporizer. And we had a guy talk to us at the prosecutor's conference. He just drove around Lexington, and he saw all sorts of vaporizers being used.
Really?
To use this stuff that's 90% pure, this marijuana. And that causes people to really be drugged out. It has psychological issues, and people get hurt. I mean, it's serious stuff.
Wayne writes, I think this is interesting. I have to go quick because we're out of time almost. I support the Lexington police, but I also support Rand Paul. Not all police are as good as Lexington's are. Recalling that police in Ferguson were not wearing their name tags or cameras. One item that Senator Paul was questioning was why the military was giving thousands of bayonets to local police. How many bayonets do the police need? That sounds like the National Guard riot suppression work. Thank God for a politician like Senator Paul, who actually is concerned about the loss of our freedoms under both Bush and especially Obama.
Okay. I just happen to think that most of the equipment that police get from the military are for their protection, so that they can, for example, Brenda Cowan, remember that case?
Yeah.
Lieutenant Brenda Cowan, Fire Department? She was killed because we didn't have the armored vehicle to go up and protect the people who would have saved her life from the shooter. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that's helpful. Look, Rand Paul probably runs a great ophthalmologist's office. And I'm very proud of him for that. But he ought to leave the law enforcement to the law enforcement.
Scott, thank you, sir.
Good to be here.
Always a pleasure to see you. David, Katie, thank you, guys.
Thank you, Jack.
See you next week, Gray.
All right.
Update from ABC.